It's showtime.
Bob Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here it is, the last day of April 2019, the 30th day of April. This is the horn for Tuesday. Trumptanic Tuesday on the horn. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. A merry band is already gathering inside the horn chat room. If you'd like to be part of it, run over to headon.live. Click on chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password. And Anatole and Jimmy and Squeaky and Terry and Saigon will all say hey when you come in. And you'll be capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Sparky, who apparently has as nice a day there in Northern California as we have here in Central Appalachia, because being a spacing guild master, he's decided to fold space and become man cave. It's been a lovely day here. Some high puffy clouds, no real threats of rain, temperature topped 80 degrees. That's right. It's a full-on springish day here, and yes, naked radio at the horn. Mm-hmm. I have to enjoy every opportunity, because probably in the not-too-distant future, we'll be doing some video here, and that'll be the end of my naked radio days, because, well, the horror. But for now, yes, right. Mm-hmm. And we always have thanks to extend here, a couple of unlooked for, unexpected thank yous for the evening. Thank you very kindly to Eric. Thanks very much, Eric, for jumping in this evening. And thank you to Clarence. Didn't expect to see anything on the last day of the month, but that was much needed and big help. It was a rain on parched earth, I can tell you that. So thank you very kindly. And it's also Patreon Thank You Day. Last day of the month, and we extend thanks to our Patreon subscribers. Thanks very kindly to Terrace in California. Thank you very kindly indeed to Hamilton in Texas. Thanks to Brother Deacon Asa. Thanks to Scott in Wisconsin. Thanks to Nick in Ohio. Thank you to Alex in Kentucky. Thanks to our buddy Horst in Taiwan. Thank you to John. John of the Bell Tower, yes, in Maryland. Thank you to Frank, and thank you to Jeremy in Vermont, to Stephen, thank you, Stephen, in Wisconsin. Thank you to Annette in Massachusetts, and to Barbara in Philly. Thanks to Ron in Delaware, to Barb in Minnesota. Thank you to Tina in Maryland, Kimberly in North Carolina, Carl in Texas. Thank you very kindly to our buddy Hung Like Jesus. Thank you to Lori in Ojai. Thank you very much to Jenny in Milwaukee, to Alec in Portland, the one in Oregon. Thank you to Vernon in San Diego. Thanks as well to TJ in California, to Frank, the author and creator of the Fab Machine. Thank you very kindly. Thanks to Albert in North Carolina. Thank you, Brendan and Jason. Thank you, Jason in California. Thank you, Glenn. Thank you, Joanne. Thank you, Marty. John. Thank you to Kat in Ohio. Thank you to Joyce. Thank you to thank you very kindly to Robin in Ohio, and thank you to Greg. That's the Patreon gang, and thanks very kindly to you. All told, this being the last day of the month, yes, about a quarter of what we rely on to keep the program going here comes in through our subscribers, either through PayPal or through Patreon, and our bottomless thanks. No, that's not a Naked Radio reference. Our endless thanks go out to each and every one of our subscribers, as well as to everyone who jumps in ad hoc or al fresco. Or, well, that kind of sounds like a Naked Radio reference, too, so no, better not. But thank you, one and all, for a successful month, another month on the air, and tomorrow we'll start fretting over the month to come, okay? So that's where it all stands. Thank you very much indeed. It is, as I said, Trump-tanic Tuesday, and we celebrate, if celebrate is the right word, and it's not. We take note of manifestations of titanic right-wing intellect on Tuesdays here at the Horn. Thank you very kindly for letting me know, Brother Deacon Asa. We're running true and hot on both the White Rose and the head-on.live stream. That's wonderful news. It's great when it works. Yeah, full speed ahead into the iceberg, say the maggots. couple of different really super duper excellent intellectual stupidity. That's the word we're looking for here. Maggot stupidity. And when it comes to manifest stupidity, well, you can't go wrong opening the program with something done by that grifting gang of burrow billies infesting the executive branch of the government. Remember, burrow billies. I'm from Appalachia, and I am therefore a hillbilly. The Trump gang, the Trump clan. They're New Yorkers, and so instead, they come from roughly Jamaica, Queens, and I do mean roughly. And so that's one of the boroughs, and so they're burrow billies. The evening probably should begin with a passage from the Constitution of the United States. That magnificent document. You know, it doesn't take a long time to read it, but if you do read through it, you're going to find that the framers really did pour a lot of effort into trying to deal with all the minutiae that comes with being a government. And so we find ourselves at Article 1, Section 6 of the Constitution of the United States, which reads, "The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid out of the Treasury of the United States." Now, this has absolutely nothing to do with what we're about to go into, but that's one of the reasons that when I see some jackass's office in the Congress who has put a sign next to his door that says, "This office belongs to the people of the first district of the state of Texas," I realize that there's a moron beyond those doors. Because the people of the first district of Texas do not pay that, and of course we all know, don't we? I'm using him as an example because he is such a stunning practitioner of titanic right-wing intellect. I'm talking about Louis Asparagus Gohmert. I don't know that he's got one of those signs, but you see him from time to time when you're walking around in Cannon or Longworth or the Rayburn House office building. And it's just dumb. It's almost always some godforsaken. It started out the people who, they also always seem to have those urine-colored snake flags. And so this office belongs to the people of the... fuck off. Because it doesn't. Article 1, Section 6 of the Constitution makes abundantly clear that that office belongs to we, the people of the United States. You know, us, out here, working on that more perfect union. Because if it was left... there are some districts out there that if it was left up to them to pay a member of the House... the only way you'd get it done would be through some sort of godforsaken crowdfunding page or something. But no, people in the more populous, more successful states pay for members of the House of Representatives to put that stupid sign up who come from districts in, the Confederacy. But again, that's not what we're talking about here. They shall, in all cases, except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses, and in going to and returning from the same, and for any speech or debate in either house. They shall not be questioned in any other place. This is what is known as the speech and debate clause of the Constitution. That last part there. And some of it harkens back to an earlier day, especially in the immediate aftermath of the ratification of the Constitution. Madison and Hamilton and Washington, Franklin et al. Knew that there were a bunch of, and I'm looking for the correct technical term, assholes out in the states who would like to screw with other members of other states. In point of fact, part of the reason for having the Constitutional Convention was because under the Articles of Confederation, certain troublemaker states, and they're always the same troublemaker states, and by that I mean places like South Carolina, were behaving in a bellicose fashion toward their sister states. It wasn't only South Carolina, but South Carolina has always been a thorn in the side of the Republic. Even before there was one. And so they wanted to make sure that nobody would be out there screwing with the members of Congress going to or from the Capitol. At one point in time, the Capitol was in New York. At another point in time, it was in Philadelphia. Eventually, by virtue of a really complicated compromise and some seriously sketchy land deals, it winds up there. We build a brand new city there on the banks of the Potomac in a swamp. And we called it Washington, D.C. And at one point in time, it took a long time to get there. I mean, if you were, say, a representative from Georgia or Massachusetts, you'd pass through several states, any one of whom could decide to be an asshole to you. So this clause of the Constitution protects members of the legislature going to and coming from their federal duties. And it also predates the First Amendment. So it guarantees to members of the national legislature a certain freedom of speech for things that they would find it necessary to say in the course and scope of their duties representing their constituents. And it applies both to the House of Representatives and to the Senate. And that clause, and for any, the and for any is a back reference to be privileged from arrest for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in other place. Any other place. Going back to that stupidity about belongs to the people of the first district. Right. Steve in New York says, right, let anyone from the district walk into the office, put their feet up, light up a cigarette, and take a nap on the couch. Sure, you bet. Well, they'd probably let them as long as they had their maggot hat on or their urine-colored snake flag jammies. Sure. But all of this has something to do with a recent monumentally stupid thing that the whole Trump family did. Not just Pappy Trump, but all the scurrying little scurrilous, criminally minded baby Trumps. You know, Ivanka and Eric and Don, too stupid to be indicted. Thanks for that, Bob Mueller Jr. Because the lot of them have decided to sue Deutsche Bank. Yes, yes, that Deutsche Bank. The same Deutsche Bank that had working for it the son of Anthony Kennedy, who had done deals, the son, for Donald J. Trump. And when the heat got onto Deutsche Bank, Kennedy decided that, you know, it's association, not causation. But he decided that he needed to go and spend more time with his family. And so he resigned from the Supreme Court and created a little space on there so that Julius Geiser could install someone who had a closely, dearly held belief that the President of the United States is at all times while he is President of the United States above the law. That Deutsche Bank. So, at the beginning of the month, a pair of House committees, in the legitimate exercise of their oversight authority, subpoenaed Deutsche Bank and Capital One, telling them to turn over their financial records regarding Donald Trump, his businesses, and the records of his immediate family who were involved in running those businesses. Deutsche Bank, which has had about as much trouble as it cares to have, said, we understand, and we will turn over the records by Monday as long as no court has told us not to. Novel. That's why the lawsuit. It is presently styled Trump versus Deutsche Bank. And it is a lulu of bad lawyering. It was filed in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, who might just be taking some looks at the Trump family anyway. Donald J. Trump, Donald J. Trump Jr., Eric Trump, and Ivanka Trump, and the Donald J. Trump Revocable Trust, the Trump Organization, Inc., Trump Organization LLC, DJT Holdings LLC, DJT Holdings Managing Member LLC, Trump Acquisition LLC, and Trump Acquisition Corp. Plaintiffs versus Deutsche Bank AG and Capital One Financial Corp. He's suing a credit card company. On one of the cable programs earlier today, Rick Wilson observed that he had spoken once with a hedge fund billionaire, a real billionaire. And I thought this rather interesting. The said billionaire told Rick Wilson, and he put all this out on a tweet, but I want to get the quote right. My galaxy brain moment on Trump was when a billionaire hedge fund manager said to me, Trump's not a billionaire. I'm a billionaire. Trump is a clown living on credit. And so this kind of looks like confirmation of that. Now, just in case you were wondering who the noble pleaders were on this, we're talking about Mark L. Mukasey of Mukasey, Frenchman, and Sklaroff, LLP, of New York City, as well as Patrick Strawbridge of Consovoy McCarthy Park, PLLC, of Boston, Mass., and William S. Consovoy, Cameron T. Norris, of Consovoy McCarthy Park, PLLC, of Arlington, Virginia. You can read the whole complaint if you want to. I'd recommend against it. It goes on for paragraph after paragraph. Something around 63 of them. And it all boils down to, please, judge, quash these subpoenas because our clients don't have a leg to stand on, but they're scared to death that the American people might find out what a bunch of low-rent, shitty little grifters they really, really, really are. And there's a little rule of thumb out there in analyzing pleadings. The more florid the prose, the shabbier the claim. This case involves congressional subpoenas that have no legitimate or lawful purpose. The subpoenas were issued to harass President Donald J. Trump, to rummage through every aspect of his personal finances, his businesses, and the private information of the president and his family. Funny how it takes that long to get to family. And to ferret about. Ferreting. There's ferreting in this lawsuit. For any material that might be used to cause him political damage. Shh. Hey, Lawyer Daggett, you might not want to confess in your first fucking paragraph that there's damaging information out there about your client. No grounds exist to establish any purpose other than a political one. Shh. Hey, Lawyer Daggett, political purposes are completely within the purview of the House of Representatives executing their oversight abilities and their oversight duties in regard to a politician. The two committees are the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and the House Financial Services Committee. And they served the subpoenas on Deutsche Bank and Capital One because Deutsche Bank and Capital One are in possession of records that do not even necessarily belong to any of that long laundry list of assholes and asshole corporations that are serving as plaintiffs in this civil action. Yep, you're right, Steve. Steve in New York. Trump's not a billionaire. Yet another time when you heard it first on the horn eons ago. So, here's the fun part. They go through all of this florid prose, and all of which is done solely and exclusively for an audience of one. And probably Ivanka will sit on his lap and read it to him. I know, everybody just went, ew. What do you want? It's the reality. Do you have any idea how many pictures there are of Ivanka sitting on her daddy's lap when she's, like, not a little girl anymore? Yeah, I found out, much to my chagrin. I mean, there's one that looks like she's giving him a lap dance. It's disgusting. Paragraph 3. The chairpersons of the Intelligence and Financial Services Committees, Adam B. Schiff and Maxine M. Waters, have confirmed the issuance of the subpoenas, making public statements to the media that emphasize their intention to probe every aspect of the private lives of the Trump family, their businesses, and even those with only the most tangential connection to Trump entities, regardless whether any... I think we need a preposition there, noble pleaders. Regardless of whether any evidence credible or otherwise, well now, so they're admitting there's credible evidence too, exists to support such intrusive probes. The committees have refused to provide copies of the subpoenas to plaintiffs, preventing them from even knowing, let alone negotiating, the subpoena's scope or breadth. Hint! You don't get to negotiate a subpoena. You don't get to say, well, okay, I'll turn this over, but I won't turn that over. That's why it's called a subpoena. It's Latin. Sub, under, poena, penalty, punishment. Under penalty of law, bring this shit up and do it quickly. And so there's all this florid bullshit preaching, and what it comes down to is they got nothing. Now, there's a little bit of a history involved in this. We need to go back to the waning days of the Vietnam War. And we need to take note of a really, really nasty old senator. He came from Mississippi. His name was James Eastland. He was a Democrat. And he was a vicious, vile, hate-filled old racist. But race doesn't really come into this. He also was being hyper-conservative, still sold on the notion of sending somebody else's mother's children over to Vietnam so they could die, as John Kerry famously noted in his congressional testimony, for a mistake. At the time, there was an organization out there called the U.S. Servicemen's Fund. And Senator James Eastland was the chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security. The U.S. Servicemen's Fund, on the other hand, was what we would understand to be a 501c3 tax-exempt nonprofit organization. And James Eastland didn't like what they did with their tax-free dollars. Because the U.S. Servicemen's Fund published newspapers, flyers, handouts, that talked about what a disgusting nightmare the Vietnam War had become. They also, in a few cities, had some coffee houses. And returning veterans would gather there and talk about the shitty experiences they'd had watching their brothers in arms get blown into a red mist in that giant, howling meat grinder mistake that deprived our country of over 55,000 members of its youth. In describing the coffee houses, they were described as, quote, focus of dissent and expressions of opposition within the military toward the war in Vietnam. Which, of course, by then had spilled over out of Vietnam and into Laos and Cambodia, but, you know, details. So that nasty old racist, James Eastland, and just as an aside, don't be surprised if you hear his name some more in connection with Joe Biden's candidacy for the presidency, because one of the things that Joe Biden has to deal with is his relentless opposition to efforts to better integrate segregated schools via busing. He worked closely with James Eastland, who despised the integration of the school systems according to the rulings of Brown v. Board of Education and its progeny. But James Eastland wanted to know all about the finances of the U.S. Servicemen's Fund. Now, at first blush, that sounds kind of abusive, doesn't it? Sounds sort of McCarthy-esque. You don't like a nonprofit's message, and so you decide to go after him. Well, James Eastland did. The U.S. Servicemen's Fund sued, and the Supreme Court, headed by that time by Warren Berger, I believe, well, they said, none of our business. Remember, this is the case that controls in the matter that the Trump clan has filed. Among other things from the holding, this. We conclude that the actions of the Senate subcommittee, the individual senators, and the chief counsel are protected by the speech or debate clause of the Constitution. The subpoenas are therefore immune from judicial interference. Once it is determined that members are acting within the legitimate legislative sphere, the speech or debate clause is an absolute bar to interference. Oh, bar. No, only one R. And so now, with that clear black-letter law, in an effort to keep the American people from finding out just how many sleazy and filthy business dealings he's been involved in, and because it mentions Deutsche Bank, remember, it was Deutsche Bank that Michael Cohen said Trump went to when he wanted them to dummy up his finances, because he had a terrible, terrible, terrible desire to buy an NFL franchise. Really, the only thing he's ever seriously wanted to do is own an NFL franchise and bask in the reflected glories of muscular, athletic, handsome, hard-bodied men. And so they're actually using that case, Eastland versus U.S. Servicemen's Fund, to complain that they're somehow being abused. The problem is, there's no abuse, and there's no way you can argue that this is not a legitimate exercise of the oversight powers of the respective committees. How about let's see if there's a legitimate legislative sphere that would trigger the speech or debate clause? Well, Auntie Maxine, who chairs the Financial Services Committee, has said that the records are needed so that the committee can investigate the, and this is a quote, potential use of the U.S. financial system for illicit purposes. Boy, it sure would be a shame if Turned out those Deutsche Bank records had a bunch of sketchy money transfers from, oh, I don't know, foreign entities that write with backwards R's and funny-looking B's and things like that. Well, I know. Arnold asks, where the Phuket did he find his legal team? That's clever. Well, this is a kid. Look, every lawyer is steeped in the idea that every client is entitled to vigorous representation, especially if you're charging $1,000 an hour or more. And you can bet the assholes at these law firms aren't working pro bono, and it ain't legal aid, and it probably is a four-figure per hour rate. If you go and you read Eastland versus U.S. Servicemen's Fund, you'll find the court stating the following. The power to investigate is inherent in the power to make laws because a legislative body cannot legislate wisely or effectively in the absence of information respecting the conditions which the legislation is intended to affect or change. In short, you cannot expect a legislative body to go about its duly constituted business in a vacuum and just sort of guess at what the state of affairs is. So there, if we lived in an ordinary America, and I say that without reference to politics, right or left, if we lived in an ordinary America where there was some value placed upon the rule of law instead of living in an America that is under a completely outlaw, lawless regime with totalitarian impulses, I'd say this is a slam dunk. I mean, there is so little merit to this pleading that it wouldn't surprise me, you know, if the defense of this, if the lawyers defending this, didn't just say, screw it, I'm filing a Rule 11 complaint. Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure says that every pleading shall be signed by a lawyer, and that when the lawyer signs that pleading, that the lawyer is certifying that that pleading is being submitted and filed not for purposes of harassment or undue delay, and that the pleading contains is based upon the law as it stands or a good faith argument for an extension or nullification of that law. I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty close. You sit in law school for 3 years and they open your cranium up and they pour this shit in and it just tends to stick. I don't know why. But it does. And I think there's an argument to be made that it was impossible to file this case in good faith. That every lawyer who signed these pleadings should be sanctioned by the court, punished by their respective bar associations, and forced to pay the costs of defending it. Because Eastland versus U.S. Servicemen's Fund is pretty clear. I read it just today. Now my head hurts. That won't happen. But if we lived in something approaching an ordinary America, notice I didn't use the word normal, this case would be bounced out on its ear with a warning not to darken the court's doorway again with it. That's not going to happen. Oh, it may get bounced out on its ear, but it will then go up to the relevant circuit, whichever one it is. I don't remember which circuit handles New York. I imagine Steve in New York knows. And then after it gets bounced out by that circuit, it will go to the Supreme Court, where we will find out if, in fact, Ann's boy Neil and Brett Kavanaugh, otherwise known as Squee, who likes beer, and Sammy Bad Breath Alito, and Clarence Pubes on the Coke Can Slappy Thomas, and John Roberts can cobble together a majority to craft some sort of narrow bullshit exception to the broad, the unmistakable holdings in Eastland. That, of course, will take some time. Because all of these filings have clock. They come with a clock, really. And so there's time to answer, time to rebut, briefing schedules, discovery, before it all comes to a head and gets ruled on by the Court of Competent Jurisdiction. And make no mistake, this is not presented as a petition for a writ of prohibition. That might not have been a bad idea. An extraordinary writ. It is presented as a civil complaint. And so arguably all the things that go with filing a civil complaint come with this. And like I said, the lawyers are doing this not because they know that not because they think they're going to win. These guys sitting in these towers who wear $5,000 suits, they're paid to know a dog when one walks in the door. And this case is a dog. Woof! But as long as the client's paying, and, you know, as long as the check clears, they figure they're golden. As long as nobody tries to get all red-assed with them and file a rule 11. And, you know, among those law firms, well, they all talk with their teeth clenched. You just don't rule 11 your fellow barristers. You don't do that. Unless, of course, the country's burning down. That's my argument. I'm sticking to it. But one way or the other, it's going to take a long time, and these records are probably not going to be released on Monday, because they're probably also seeking a temporary restraining order or something that goes with that, telling Deutsche Bank, don't you dare. The other thing, though, that it does it buys some time. Deutsche Bank has proven itself over the years to be absolutely filthy. Crooked, as we've been saying lately, of Bill Barr, as a dog's hind leg. And willing to engage in any amount of slippery, sleazy, dodgy, skeevy financial conduct if they think there's a euro in it. And it could just be that this is going to provide a sufficient amount of time for Deutsche Bank and for the Trump administration to engage in a little bit of conspiracy and try to dummy up the records and clean them up and oops, the dog ate it and oh my God, it was blown away. All the records were blown away in that big tornado that ripped through downtown Manhattan. Because if you sit down and soberly try to analyze something like this, that's the only thing that resembles a rationale. It's when the cops are knocking on the door, banging on the door, and all the crooks scurry for the windows and trying to get under the bed and behind the curtains and you know, Bugs Bunny stuffs Muggsy in the oven and says, "Hey, ain't in here. If my buddy Muggsy was in here, would I turn the gas on?" "Yeah, you might, Rabbit. You might. Would I light a match and throw it in?" "All right, we'll look for Muggsy in the city." So they're buying time. And it's the same thing with the other lawsuit that they've filed directly against members of Congress, in which case, yes, Eastland versus U.S. Servicemen's Fund is even clearer. Speech or debate clause is all over that one. But there's an outside wager to be made that Clarence Pubes on the Coke can, Slappy Thomas, and the rest of them will do what is expected of them because Republicans do that kind of thing to protect other Republicans. It would otherwise be laughably stupid to have even filed this thing. But this is par for the course with Trump all his life.
I'll sue you for every penny you've got, and then I'll lose my ass.
He never wins. Trump University, anybody? The very first legal proceeding in which he was involved as a young grifter, when his old Klansman daddy grifter was still alive. And they were sued by the United States government for the racists that they were in their landlord practices. All they had to do was sign a consent decree and say, "We won't do it anymore." And they're out for next to nothing. No harm, no foul. But instead, because he was a super genius back then too, Donald Trump goes out and hires Roy Cohn, who makes matters a billion times worse and winds up getting them stone cold busted. If we live in an ordinary world, this case is disposed of quickly, it gets fast-tracked, and Congress gets the records that it has an absolute legal right to possess. You can argue that, hell, the Trumps don't even have standing in this. The Trumps are not parties to the transaction, nor are any of their grifty, skeezy, skeevy, creepy, filthy companies. And that raises a second question. Yeah, the subpoenas had to be voted on in committee. I'm sure all the Republicans voted against them. But at what point in time did the lawyers find out about them? Because even the lawyers crafting these pleadings weren't privy wait for it, were not privy to the subpoenas themselves because they weren't served on any Trumps. So that means that there had to be a little bit of, dare I say it, collusion with Deutsche Bank. Did Deutsche Bank send the subpoenas over? Or did these noble pleaders run down to the courthouse and just get print off copies from the electronic file? I tend to forget we live in an electronic legal age now, and I guess you can just do that. But they have no standing. The subpoenas seek records that are owned and in the possession of Deutsche Bank, not any records that are owned or in the possession of any of those Trump entities. This ought to be one first semester 1L easy, no later than second semester, about halfway through civil procedure probably. No, Steve, I'm never going to hate you, buddy. Steve with a note says, you're going to hate me. I'm going to confess something. I came to a conclusion long ago that I don't follow the rules anymore, as a general matter, other than the rules regarding privilege and dealing with safeguarding client money. Why? To do so, for the reasons you're articulating right now, puts one's client at a disadvantage. In my practice, there's little I will not do to represent my client's interests, whether it runs afoul of the rules. So, I guess you could say that Auntie Maxine looked at Capital One and said, "What's in your wallet?" I know. Lee in New York says, "Stop it with the law talk, Bob. I feel like I need to be a lawyer to continue listening. Rule 11, all I know about that is they wrote it after Rule 10. Well, that's why I explained it. We would do well to be a little bit better educated on the workings of the law. Now, I don't know, Flavio. Flavio asks, what's a friendly subpoena? How is that different from a regular unfriendly subpoena? I'm asking because I heard the Deutsche Bank and Capital One subpoenas were friendly subpoenas. Are friendly subpoenas negotiable? Well, I guess you would term it a friendly subpoena insofar as there is no civil or criminal action contemplated against those parties as such. It is non-adversarial, I guess you would say, because the case was not filed, and Deutsche Bank and Capital One have not filed anything. They're going to sit there and do what they're supposed to do. Billable Rick has awarded a cowbell to Arnold up in PA. A cowbell needs to be awarded for the line, "Where the Phuket did he find his legal team?" Well, you know, when the committee speaks, I listen. Again, this shouldn't even be an issue. And I don't know if the, you know, barring some sort of an intrusion via a restraining order, I don't know that this stops Deutsche Bank and Capital One from complying with the damn subpoenas. I mean, if it was a friendly, that's as close as I can get, Flavio, for a friendly subpoena. Maybe Rick's got a better definition. But this ain't the Cayman Islands, and it's certainly not Switzerland. And banks don't get to just thumb their noses at courts and governments, particularly in the lawful pursuit of their constitutionally mandated duties. Ah, Jesus, really? Thanks. Robert up in Morgantown sending along some breaking news. I'm trying to see if I can find any more. Any more on it. See if it's popped anywhere. Give me a sec. Not seeing it. KDKA-TV in Pittsburgh. Reporting that two people have been killed. And others have life-threatening injuries. In yet another attack. This one with the NRA's roulette wheel of death landing on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Reporting coming in from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. Let me see if I can bring that up so we can get the... And then again, there's the question of, you know, why are we doing that? Why am I doing this? Primarily, I suppose, just to get the details.
Behind a computer and have been for, you know, the past hour. So it is not necessarily over for the people involved in the situation
right,
who are in these halls and in these buildings. There are still people that are very scared, unsure what's happening. They're trying to get information and trying to get their phone numbers and make sure that they know what's happening if they're not active on Twitter or they're not being able to watch a television right now.
Of course.
And what they've been told is to stay in place until a police officer comes to you to tell you that it is safe to leave that building. So, and obviously that's taking some time to go from room to room. WBTV Steve Crump is on the telephone with us. Steve, you've been in this community as long as anyone, reporting on the news. We haven't had too many active shooter situations like this right here in the city of Charlotte. As a matter of fact, nothing jumps to mind right away. Quite
one active shooter situation is too many active shooter situation, the news guy.
One, I was on the way home driving along US 29 when this story broke, and I happened to see a lot of police and fire vehicles heading towards the UNC Charlotte campus. The other thing I noticed, too, and not necessarily realizing what was going on, is the fact that light rail was, in fact, running. Now, in terms of perspective and things that I've covered over the years, the one flashback that immediately comes to mind are the several days that I spent at Virginia Tech. I remember getting to Virginia Tech hours after that shooting, and the reality is when you look at what happened there and if you try to mimic what's going on at UNC Charlotte, there will be a heavy federal presence that will basically take over. From what I'm being told from one of my sources, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, they have agents that are on the way there. So, you know, this is going to be a shared responsibility between CMPD, UNC Charlotte, along with the feds. The other thing, this has become a national story. I've been told that a crew from the CBS Evening News is on the way to Charlotte, should be getting here around 9 o'clock this evening. But what we'll probably see right now is a perimeter, and again, as Carly DeLaguerra points out so aptly, is the fact that they are going from building to building just to make sure that, you know, everyone is safe and that they can account for the people that are there. But again, there's a perimeter, most likely, that's being set up as it relates to law enforcement, you know, who gets on campus, who gets off campus. And again, flashing back to Virginia Tech, I can tell you from personal experience, this story is going to last for several days.
It certainly will, obviously, but this is going to be some time. Steve Crump giving us his perspective, having been to Virginia Tech and covered that horrible story there years ago. But we are watching it happen right here on the campus of UNC Charlotte. We can confirm, CMPD says, two people dead, four people hurt, two with life-threatening injuries.
Medic also confirming that this is videotape that you are seeing right now from Sky 3 from earlier this afternoon. All this happening. between 5:30 and 6 o'clock tonight. So hour and a half ago at this point. And this is some video and from earlier where you can see what looks like a stretcher there being taken away. You see the medic ambulance at the bottom of the screen next to the
sorry about the UCs. I'm just trying to see if we can find out the basic details.
Any distance of this campus responded and responded quickly. We saw those images earlier of students being led away from that scene while police officers were running towards Kennedy Hall to do their best to neutralize any potential threat as it was ongoing. The good news we are hearing is that there is a suspect in custody tonight. CMPD sources is telling our Molly Grantham that don't appear to be any other suspects or a second shooter at this point. That is certainly some encouraging news. And here is some video that we are seeing right now from pictures of Sky 3. That could be the suspect right there, Maureen.
Yeah, we're looking as Sky 3 captured the scene. You see the law enforcement with one person handcuffed, and they put them into the back of that vehicle. You see several officers arriving to assist this person being put in the back of what appears to be one of the campus police cruisers, right, Jamie?
Yeah, it appears that way. It doesn't appear to be a CMPD vehicle at this point. They are handling that person right now, putting them into the back. The question becomes, who is that person? What was their motivation? What is this all about? Those are questions that police are going to be asking. Here's
again
a loop of that one more time as you see us replay it right there as they hustle that person out and into the back seat of that police car to be taken away for questioning. Where that will happen, we don't know at this point. We do have crews all over this story right now. We have crew at the hospital trying to get more information.
Do you ever get the sense that when one of these things happens that there really isn't much in the way of viable information? We just heard a lot of nothing. WRAL out of North Carolina, again, reporting two dead, two others with life-threatening injuries, one person in custody. The shots were reported at about 10 minutes before 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The university sent out an emergency alert message to students at UNC Charlotte, in which they were told to, quote, run, hide, fight. I get the run part. I certainly understand the hide part. Anybody care to take a run at the fight part? There was a free Waka Flocka Flame concert scheduled for 6 p.m. on campus. Don't know if that's got any relevance whatsoever. I would suggest that the most relevant thing would be that there was a guy with a fucking gun who went into one of the buildings and began shooting. And what more do we say? What more is there to say? That we really need to do something about guns? Well, okay. Haven't we been saying that since at least Sandy Hook? Because I'm pretty sure we have. Didn't we say that after Tree of Life? Shabbat of Poway? So we say it again. But until such time as the people who cover for the killers are driven from office, we don't even have a fighting chance of stopping this. How do you have a conversation, and I'm not being a smartass here. If you've got the answer, I want to know. Phone lines are open. How do you go about having a conversation with people in a state who have been sending the same monster to the Senate for the last couple of decades? To the coal barons in Kentucky. When you walk up to them and say, listen, Mitch is getting our children killed because he won't do anything to protect them, and he destroys every piece of legislation that comes his way. We got to be rid of Mitch McConnell. How do you talk to that coal baron when he says, yeah, but he's real good for my business? That's the most profound disconnect any culture can have. When you walk into the First Baptist Church of Bowling Green, and you plead with them and you say, listen, Mitch McConnell is a big part of why so many of our children keep dying. Please, please, won't you find somebody to replace him with that cares about our children? And they say, well, Mitch cares about the fetuses, and that's the children we care about. Praise Jesus. How do you fix a country that is that deeply dysfunctional? How do you say that in Texas about John Cornyn? How do you convince Louisianans and Mississippians who aren't even particularly happy about the number of people who are allowed to vote in the first place, that maybe we'd like to stop burying our babies? And they reply, yeah, we gotta have some small government. Because, see, that's the essential problem here. We can have presidential elections till hell freezes over. We can even win a bunch of them. But until the people of Kentucky love their children more than coal bosses love Mitch McConnell, until the people of Texas love their children more than John Cornyn loves the fossil fuel industry, until the people of both states love their families more than those politicians love the NRA and all the money they bring, the blood will continue to flow. And the children will continue to die. There's nobody. Whoever it was that got shot and killed in Charlotte this evening, somebody loved them. I would say, and never dreamed that something that like this might happen, but it is now 2019 in the United States of America, and if you have a child, you have at some point in time contemplated the reality that thanks to organizations like the NRA and the politicians they buy and who stay bought, it very well might happen to your child someday. Because we have literally millions of people in this country who love their guns more than they love kids. At least kids who aren't fetuses. It's a fact. Let's run over and check in on the Skype line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Yeah.
Hey, it's Bill Woolrich.
Hey, Bill Woolrich. What's happening, man?
Hey, I had to weigh in here with all the talk about the Trump lawsuit against Deutsche Bank and with regard to the subpoenas.
Well, before we do that, since I sort of ran off to this latest episode of bloodshed and mayhem.
Okay.
Am I missing anything? Is there anything that this country can do until individual states decide to shed themselves of the people who are getting our babies killed? You got anything?
Are we talking about the North Carolina mass shooting? What are we talking about?
Yeah, well, I mean, right. See, that's the country we live in now. We're not even sure which mass shooting we're talking about. Hell, there may be another one in 15 minutes.
Well, it's ironic. I was just listening to the February 2018 shows from Norman Goldman on his archive, and they were talking about the Parkland shootings back then, like, what, Valentine's Day 2018. So it's like, you know, no matter how far back you go, and even not that far back, you know, you're gonna get an account of a shooting. It's ridiculous, you know? I really don't know what to do about it, Bob. I think we've kind of become immune to it to some extent, you know? I think what you need to do is you almost need to show the carnage on billboards, but then people would eventually get immune to that as well, you know what I'm saying? So, I don't know.
I don't think you need to see the carnage. I don't need to see the carnage.
Oh, I know that. Yeah, but people who...
But by God, it's sort of like after the Second World War, in France, the people who had collaborated with the Nazis, the ones that didn't get executed.
Right.
The ones they decided to let live, they shaved their heads and marched them down the middle of Main Street so everybody could know who they were.
Right, right.
And good Germans were taken into the death camps to see what had been going on.
Right. Yeah.
And even that wasn't 100% successful. But maybe you need to take Wayne LaPeter or Coleon Noir.
Right.
Or Greg Stinkfield.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or Dana Lush. And literally take them to one of these scenes and rub their goddamn faces and their noses in the blood and the gore and the guts and say, "Are you happy now?"
Yeah, I mean, it's really...
Because nothing else is working, Rick.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as I've said, Bob, I think the only time we're ever going to get the NRA to change its position on sensible gun reform is if somebody, attacks their building and it's a mass, shooting there. I'm not suggesting that, obviously, because that's not my nature. But,
no, and I don't even know that would work, Rick, because remember, they just had their big Clavering rally in Taliban Indianapolis.
Right.
And, of course, that whole auditorium, especially when the nitwit Nero was there, was a gun-free zone. They know how dangerous their members are.
Right, right, yes, exactly.
And so they won't let them carry their guns into the auditorium for fear that, mayhem may break out.
Well, and that's good reason, because, a trumpanzee and a gun is a bad combination, sort of like, allowing guns and bars, which, of course, is allowed in some states. I think Arizona lets you do that, and who knows where else you can do that,
Yeah, what a great idea.
Yeah, what could go wrong, right? Oh, man. It's like you can only talk so much about it, and then the thoughts and prayers get to be, pretty putrid and vapid after a while,
I'm all thoughts and prayered out.
I mean, I don't even think people are saying that anymore. I think they've moved.
Oh, no. I checked out the the Facebook page of the broadcast whose audio I brought on, and there were thoughts and prayers on there. Yes,
oh,
thoughts and prayers.
Oh, well, that's good. That'll do a lot to stop the bullets, in my opinion, Bob. I mean, that's, you know, right?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, it's really a sad commentary on our country. I mean, we've always been a violent country, but, you know, you'd think once we get to a certain stage of development, you'd think that we would maybe advance a little bit beyond this Wild West mentality and have to, you know, everybody feel like they have to be gunned up and, you know, putting guns in the hands of, you know, people who have no business owning a gun. So was that a predominantly black college or what?
There's 25,000, I think, more than 25,000 students on that campus.
Okay. Is this the University of North Carolina?
Yeah, this is UNC Charlotte.
Oh, shit, UNC Charlotte. Oh, geez. Okay. Wow. I almost went to law school there. I was accepted there to UNC Charlotte. Well, so what's the toll right now? Do you know?
Two dead, two severely wounded, and shooter in custody.
Okay.
Of course, they never assume that they've gotten all the shooters until they've swept all the buildings, because you never know when one of these maggots is gonna, you know, get a few other maggots together. Because, bear with me here for a minute, Rick.
Certainly.
You know, the early days of the American Civil War were, you know, Pierre Gustave Toutant Beauregard yelling "Bah!" and, you know, they lobbed shells at Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, and then you've got a skirmish in Barber County in what is now West Virginia that was the first land battle, and then the next thing you know, it's First Bull Run, and there were armies lined up on either side. But that's not how civil wars usually go, and I don't even like talking about this in this context, but these are attacks. And they resemble a civil war more than any more they resemble terrorism. Because we've got a white wing out there that's hollering civil war, civil war, civil war, civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't holler that forever without a few people taking you up on it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've had, we've seen incidents recently that, like, the maggot who was sending bombs to the, you know, Democratic leadership, former president, Biden, you know, to the media, you know. And he, of course, was, you know, a super maggot with all the, you know, photos of Trump on his hand and what have you, you know, which the authorities could not cover up because the winds kept blowing them off. They kept blowing the sheet off, or whatever they had.
Yeah, and remember, the guy has communicated to the court that, and he blames this is Cesar Sayoc. He blames steroids for it, but he also says that when, and this is a quote from he said, "When I discovered Trump, it was like a new drug."
Well, I think that's pretty emblematic of all of these maggots, Bob. A lot of these, you know, politically oriented acts of terror. I mean, I think it really is terrorism. I do understand the Civil War aspect, where you're coming at it from there. But, you know, usually you have to have, like, two armed sides there in a Civil War, generally.
Well, sort of, but that's not, you know, that's not necessary. I mean, go look at the Balkan Wars of the 90s.
Okay.
Yeah, part of the reason there were so many war crimes out of that is that people were simply rounded up and murdered.
Right. Like, I know in Sarajevo, basically there was an area where if anybody, like, tried to walk through the square, they'd get shot at, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or were just rounded up and machine gunned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's
so
that's.
Where were you going with the thread then?
Well, no, that was just the idea that eventually there's some sort of critical mass where people are going to start going in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
Look at that in the aftermath of the Chabad of Poway shooting on Saturday.
Right.
Then yesterday we've got this breathless announcement that the FBI has foiled a Muslim terror plot. And the reason they were able to foil that is because, A, the guy had no ability to really do much of anything.
Right.
And, B, they actively monitor places where people would talk about that sort of thing. But, they don't spend so much time on 8chan. Because remember, the Trump administration de-emphasized domestic terrorism.
Right, exactly.
You can't talk about all of this stuff being perpetrated by young white males who are as often as not maggots, more often than not maggots, and not remember that the Trump administration de-emphasized domestic terrorism at a federal level.
Right. They have. I think there was a program or office or more, probably more than one office or program that they've shut down.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're fine with it. That tells me they're fine with it, right? What other conclusion is there to draw from that?
Well, this ain't really domestic terrorism. This is, sometimes people with guns just go a little crazy and then they go shoot up a school or a church or a synagogue mostly, or maybe a mosque. But, that ain't terrorism. That's just people going crazy with guns, and we got to protect our rights to have guns to go crazy with.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
What was the lawsuit the other day? The NRA gave, according to the lawsuit, the NRA gave more than 9,529 times as much money as they were legally allowed to Trump.
Oh, my God. Is that a good government organization that's suing them or what?
It's an NGO of some sort, yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember the name. I covered it at the time. I think maybe it was Friday or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. Wow.
Maybe Thursday.
9,500 times the legal amount. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And I don't know. And we don't. And we to this day do not know how many of those dollars had been previously converted from rubles.
No, we don't. We don't. I mean, you wonder who's investigating that. I mean, I think that was one of the spinoffs from the Mueller probe. I think that part of the case. I don't know. maybe it's going to just die. That case. Maybe no charges will ever be brought because of the, power of the NRA.
And so it would seem that the first thing that has to be done is to is to shatter the NRA.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make it, and I realize I'm probably swimming against the current here based on the present situation, but make it as nasty to belong to the NRA as it is to belong to the Klan.
Yeah.
Of course, right. If you drew a Venn diagram of NRA membership, you'd probably have some overlap there with the circle that said Klan.
Well,
it's impossible you wouldn't.
Yeah, I seem to remember back in the 1990s, I think the Southern Poverty Law Center sued, was it Operation Rescue, Randall Terry?
I'm not sure if it was
out of business.
Yeah, they put the Klan and Randall Terry out of business.
Yeah, the Klan as well. White Aryan Nation, maybe, is what I'm thinking of. That got sued out of existence up in Idaho. They had like a base in Coeur d'Alene or whatever, at the very tip of the state. The four north reaches of Idaho.
Yeah. Randy Weaver.
Yeah. It wasn't Randy Weaver. It was. He's the guy who was involved with one of those standoffs where...
Yeah, that's who I was thinking. But you said Idaho, and that's where I immediately went.
Yeah. I mean, it's people like that. But, you know, what you got to do is you got to take away their assets, and then they can't do shit, essentially, you know? Then they're basically, you know, atomized. And then they have to form some other new group.
And see, that's one of the while we're at it, the Attorney General of the state of New York is presently investigating the NRA, and we know about it because Julius Geezer tweeted about it. So unfair, so unfair. Because they were running a scam, the NRA was, selling insurance in New York that they were not legally licensed to sell.
Oh, geez. Wow.
Okay, yeah, Darlene got the details for us, Darlene in Connecticut. It's an organization founded by Gabrielle Giffords, suing the Federal Election Commission for failing to enforce campaign finance laws against the NRA for giving more money to Trump than was legal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the first problem they're going to have is standing. In the 1970s...
Taxpayer standing?
Do they have a sufficiently concrete injury, though? You know, taxpayer standing is kind of a weak read debate.
Well, yeah, it is. That's why I mentioned it. That's not...
Yeah. I mean, back in the day, Bob, I mean, what allowed us to have a lot of these landmark wins for the environmental rights was that... you know, these groups were given the right to essentially sue on behalf of, you know, wilderness areas or on behalf of, you know, a certain species of animals or what have you, you know. But that broad idea of standing has really been curtailed for the last 40 years, you know. So it's really not that, you know, unfortunately... you know, it's just not that easy these days. So, you know, I suspect that case will get bounced out. There probably won't even be any discovery for Gabby Giffords' group, unfortunately.
So segueing over to what you originally called about, since that's just an ordinary complaint, you know, Trump scumbags versus Deutsche Bank and Capital One, since it's just a complaint, do they get discovery?
Well, I think what they might have is they might have a third party whose records are subject of a subpoena. I believe under the Right to Financial Privacy Act, they have a right to try to quash the subpoena.
Yeah, they do. They do cite that.
Yeah. So
do the two congressional committees have a right to implead third party practice?
I don't think. Okay, so the congressional committees, can they become a party to the case?
I mean, we know damn sure that they can be sued as defendants because the Trumps have done that.
Okay, so let's see here. So Deutsche Bank has been sued. I don't see how.
I mean, is this a fishing expedition by the Trumps to find out just what they've got? So that hopefully the federal judge will say, well, bring it all in here and I'll review it and, you know, take a look and blah, blah.
Well, I think the Trumps know what they got. They obviously, this is a sore spot, so that's why they've...
They're scared to damn death.
Yeah. And I think their goal, Bob, is to try to slow walk this through the 2020 election. So that if and when this information does come out, that, you know, won't matter, at least from the standpoint that at least Trump will either be, you know, reelected, God forbid, or he'll be out. And it just won't matter at that point in time. So I think they're doing it.
But it can be fast-tracked.
Yeah, it can be fast-tracked. I mean, normally you don't file a full-blown complaint to quash a subpoena.
Yeah, you would go after some sort of extraordinary writ or, you know, a writ of prohibition.
Or under the Right to Financial Privacy Act. You could just file a lawsuit under that. And in that lawsuit, you move to quash the subpoena that's been served on the third party, and the proper defendant would be the party that issued the subpoena, not the party who's required to comply with the subpoena. And then the party that's required to comply with the subpoena will then have to act in accordance to whatever the result of the lawsuit is. If the motion to quash is granted, then they can just not turn over the records. If it's denied, then they got to turn over the records. And yeah, there could be an appeal from the decision, let's say to deny the motion to quash, and that would go up to the Circuit Court of Appeals. And I think what you probably have, Bob, is I'm not so sure that the speech and debate clause is determinative as to that lawsuit. I think what you do is you weigh the right. It's probably a balancing test, without actually researching the issue. I'm sort of, shooting from the hip here, and I know some of our other barristers who listen can correct me if I'm wrong, but it probably involves a balancing of the person whose records are being sought, their privacy rights, versus the right of the subpoenaing party to get the information. So, I think it's...
Well, I think part of the reason they filed it the way they did was to keep the committees out of and keep the chairs out of it, so that they couldn't affirmatively go in and go speech or debate clause, and so they argue the Financial Privacy Act. But the problem with that is, if you go and look at it, there are procedures that the committees can remedy relative to that simply by jumping through the hoops in the Financial Privacy Act. It's not impossible.
No, it's not. It's not. This is not like some, secret weapon that that parties whose records are being sought can use to quash a subpoena. I mean, I don't think it. I don't think,
because these noble pleaders are making the argument that somehow or another, there's no legitimate purpose in seeking these documents, when that is a standard that is really, really hard to get across the finish line.
Yeah, I mean, all you have to show is that this may be relevant to, potential relevance, which is very broad. It's not like, it's not like you have to have a reasonable suspicion, or you've got to have probable cause that certain records are going to reflect evidence of a crime or something like that. You just and again, it's a congressional inquiry, so you have a very broad just by nature, Congress has broad powers of oversight, and that is something that will come into play. And I think if the Trump folks are trying to sidestep the ability to Congress to get involved in the lawsuit by going directly after Deutsche Bank, I think the real party in interest is probably the U.S. House, whatever committee issued the subpoena. So I could see a scenario where the U.S. House is substituted as the real party in interest, as the defendant, in place and in lieu of Deutsche Bank. Because they're just sort of, they're just stuck in the middle. They're not really...
Well, the ad damnum clause to the lawsuit, the plea for relief, prayer for relief, it gives us a little idea of what's going on in these Clarence Darrow wannabes' minds.
Mm-hmm.
They frame it in the terms of a deck action. They ask for declaratory judgment that those particular subpoenas are invalid and unenforceable.
Mm.
Then they ask for a permanent injunction.
Mm-hmm.
Then they and the permanent injunction quashes the subpoenas. So they're asking for a permanent injunction against the committees who are not party.
Mm.
Then they ask in paragraph C for a permanent injunction against Deutsche Bank and Capital One from, quote, disclosing, revealing, delivering, or producing the requested information, or otherwise complying with the subpoenas. Paragraph D, they want a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction that prohibits Deutsche Bank and Capital One from disclosing, revealing, delivering, yada, yada, yada. And then, of course, E, money. Plaintiffs' reasonable costs and expenses, including attorney's fees.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can't read the, it's difficult to take this seriously.
Well, but you it can, is, but then, you but, know, I mean...
But then these are not difficult. Ordinary times.
Well, it's difficult to take seriously the fact that, you know, the Trump travel ban was upheld by the Supreme Court despite all of the statements of animus that were, you know, that should have been part of the record as to, you know, what Trump had in mind in drafting the executive order, you know, or at least the predecessor orders that were, you know...
So, in essence, it could be a situation where the court would say, we got lots of deference for the president, but we don't have nearly as much deference for the Congress, which would turn 200-plus years of constitutional precedent on its ear. But that's been happening a lot lately.
Well, you know, like you can be too dumb to be charged with obstruction,
precisely,
right?
Yeah.
Well... Yeah, this is very strange. I mean, you would think that at least a normal Supreme Court would see a case like this, assuming they even would accept it, okay? I mean, they could just, you know, in the past, they wouldn't touch this kind of thing because they would think, frivolous. But because the president's a party, you know, that kind of ups the ante. But in the past, they would look at this like say, look, you know, this is a separate and coequal branch that's trying to do its oversight work. The executive is trying to prevent them from doing so by, you know, moving to quash the subpoena. This is a political question that we're not going to tackle. We're going to let Congress do, you know, what it want, what it's.
Congress has a right, a legitimate purpose in doing what it's doing. Turn over the damn documents and darken our doorway no more.
Exactly. And I noticed that one of the noble pleaders that you mentioned is Mark Mukasey. I believe that's the former attorney general under dim leader, George W. Bush.
Really?
It's either that or his son. It's either that or his son. Yeah.
I didn't remember a Mukasey.
Mukasey, yes.
I remembered Alberto Torture Boy Gonzalez.
This guy came after Torture Boy Gonzalez. This is at the tail end of the Bush administration. The tail end of the reign of air, yeah. Yeah, it was Mark Mukasey, I believe. Oh. I know he's got a son who's an attorney, so...
well, let's look him up. I did not recognize his name.
Yeah, he's a former judge on the Second Circuit Court of Appeal, which covers New York.
No, that was Michael Mukasey.
Oh, Michael. Okay, Marcus's son, I believe.
He was W's AG.
Yeah.
After Torture Boy resigned.
Right. That's right. It was Michael was.
And
AG.
he was brought on specifically because he served 18 years as the chief judge of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I guess the SDNY is supposed to go, wow, okay, I mean, we know Mark. We've had cocktails, and he knows which fork to use to eat the shrimp with.
Hey, that's a hard argument to overcome there, Bob. Yeah, right. Oh, geez. Well, in normal times, I would say this case is going nowhere, but... you know, I said the same thing about the travel ban, you know, and that was found to be valid by the Supreme Court, you know. I mean, that's going to go right down there with the, Korematsu decision, you know, with regard to Japanese internment, that was legal by FDR to do that, you know. It'll definitely go down to the annals of history as one of the worst, you know, worst reasoned decisions ever, you know. So... yeah,
the sad thing is you can't look at something as ridiculous and egregious as this and say, well, this doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell. because
no, you can't.
It,
yeah.
I guess, does.
Well, you know,
as long as you've got a court system that has been as thoroughly corrupted as this one has been in the short span of a little over 800 days.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this case, if it goes on and is allowed to see, you know, Supreme Court review or what have you, I mean, that would be almost equivalent to, I mean, the arguments being made here, Bob, are not much different than, you know, the tax protesters I used to encounter who said that they were not subject to the federal tax laws because they were a citizen of the California Republic but not of the United States, which is a corporation headquartered in Washington, D.C. So the only difference between an argument like that and what Trump is arguing is the identity of the pleader, right?
What's wow. So, you know wait. I think this is kind of important. You've basically just said that Donald Trump is pleading a sovereign citizen case.
I suppose so. Yeah. I'm the king. Yeah. Now is he going to get crowned at the Washington Cathedral, or where is he going to get crowned, Bob?
Yosh.
Or is he going to go to... No, he can't go to Notre Dame. That's been burned. Jeez. Oh, man. Yeah, that's what it's come down to, Bob. You know? We got to get this fucker out by any legal means necessary. He ain't going to be impeached. He's got to be thumped at the ballot box somehow. And we've got to, like, really be on our guard.
We got to count on one of two octogenarians probably to do that.
Yep, and we need our own citizens counterintelligence operation to counter the Ruskies, who you know are going to be like screwing with things everywhere possible. So we basically need a geek squad. The geek squad may save us, may save our democracy, Bob, if they can, you know, counter the Ruskies that are going to definitely be invading, you know, key states and election systems.
Well, I don't know if you caught it, but the other day, Christopher Wray of the FBI was interviewed, I think, by that Council on Foreign Relations guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Christopher Wray said, well, yeah, the Russians are going to keep doing it. But the Chinese are in the game now, too. And then, lo and behold, earlier today, I saw a story out of Europe where Vodafone, which is a huge conglomerate, has discovered that the Chinese, and, you know, everything, every corporation in China is run by the government. It's a thugocracy.
State-owned, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Huawei routers that were discovered to have back doors in them, and when the Chinese were told, you need to work. And they just never did. And so if you're in Europe and you've got a Huawei router, the People's Republic of China has there's not even a door. It's just an open gangway.
Wow. And you know, Bob, that China is going to be all in for Trump as well, because the guy is so fucking incompetent. And his leadership has weakened America dramatically in just a little over 2 years. And they're hoping, I mean, yeah, maybe it's a good thing for the empire to collapse, you know? I don't know.
You don't want to be around when that happens, Rick.
Well, I know, but that's clearly the direction we're heading, and it's heading,
I mean, we've got,
heading that way a lot more rapidly.
We got way too many burn baby burn types in this country now. Please don't join them.
No, oh God, no, Bob. I can't do that. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a warrior. I'm a lawyer, Bob. You know.
Yeah. I'm a lawyer. Not a fighter. Sorry, my Michael Jackson is really terrible.
No, that's okay. That's okay. You have pretty good impression. So, yeah. Anyway, so much for the ray of sunshine here. It's like, you know.
Well, but I mean, if those are the cards we're dealt, we have to play them. I mean, you can't lay down a busted flush and say I win.
Right. But I mean, I think we do need like a citizens, you know, counter intelligence operation, because I don't think we can necessarily count on the U.S. government to do anything because, you know, the executive branch, right? I mean, you know, maybe there are enough loyal agents in the FBI who, who will...
I'm still kind of sketchy on that based on what, I forget who it was, said the other night. You know, we wind up recruiting FBI agents from authoritarian cultures in this country, and so you're not going to get a lot of liberal people wildly in love with constitutional liberties.
No, that's true. That's true. Yeah, that's. I mean, it's always. You know, the Nazi types have always been more attracted towards, you know, law and order, you know, unfortunately, you know.
The authoritarian mindset, you know, we'd rather thinking for yourself is so complicated.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You got it. All right, Bob, well, great show.
Well, thank you.
I'll move along for another one of the ordinary, extraordinary members of your audience.
That's our community, Rick, not mine.
Our community. Right.
All right, Rick, you take care and maybe catch you Friday on the front porch.
Sounds good. Happy early May Day and happy anniversary coming up tomorrow for you.
Thank you, the lovely
warrior goddess.
Viking, you know, the Viking warrior pharaoh princess.
There you go.
26 right, years. 26 years. I don't know how I got so lucky.
Well, congratulations, man. Keep it up.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, Rick. Take care now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. The one and only Billable Rick, unofficial and not really house counsel to the horn. Let's see here. A couple of emails. I think I just caused Tracy to say bad words. Hold up, wait a goddamn minute. Sir, are you trying to tell me that the same asshats that fight for the right so a maggot can open carry his freedom protector into a Wally World or onto a school campus will not allow guns during their clavering meeting so they can have a fucking gun-free zone and we can't? Can we say hypocrisy? What the entire fuck? So, like the tobacco industry back in the day, these assholes know how deadly their products are, but they've decided to do fuck all about it. Thanks again for being the bearer of great news, Bob. I'm going to now drown my sorrows in a very large slice of... Oh, you're hurting me now. A very large slice of strawberry and blueberry vanilla layer cake with whipped cream frosting. Oh, you know how to hurt a guy. You really, really do. Note coming from Glenn in San Diego. Please convey my eternal gratitude to Scott for introducing me and hopefully other members of the Horn community to Daniel Sheehan, co-founder of the Romero Institute. It may have been Friday on the front porch when Scott barely mentioned just before signing off, as he does, one of Sheehan's YouTube videos titled What Mueller Missed, the narrative no one is talking about. Sheehan's bona fides are impeccable, which for me lends a lot of credibility to what he has to say. He was the attorney for Daniel Ellsberg. He also successfully litigated both the Karen Silkwood and Three Mile Island cases against Kerr McGee, one of the results of which is that there has not been a single nuclear power plant built in the U.S. since. After watching What Mueller Missed, I was enticed to watch more of his lectures, which are no less fascinating. I thought that I was pretty well informed on historical events such as Watergate, Iran-Contra, etc., but Sheehan manages to connect dots from various past events and people which lead to the scenario in which we live today, including Trump's involvement with Russian officials and oligarchs that both stun and enlighten. For anyone who loves to go inside baseball when it comes to historical political intrigue, Daniel Sheehan can really pitch some red meat. He's pretty much convinced me that if we want the separation of powers to survive, if we want co-equal branches of government to survive, if we want to save the Constitution from being nothing more than a piece of paper while saving our country from a fascist takeover, then Congress must investigate, subpoena, all the while hanging impeachment over Trump's head like the sword of Damocles until the evidence is so undeniable that even Republicans have to submit to the truth, or better yet, be pounded into the dustbin of history in November 2020. Thanks again to my neighbor, Scott. That's signed Glenn. Thank you, Glenn. And I've got to check these out myself, no doubt about it. I'd love to figure out, and let me know if you do, I'd love to figure out a way to pound these Republican senators into the dustbin of history. But it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the conversation you have to have with Kentucky. You're not going to have a hard time having that conversation with, say, the district that John Yarmuth represents in Louisville. But good luck having that conversation in Louisa. Or as our buddy Dennis can attest, it's lawn mowing season again. I imagine Dennis and I'll be cutting the grass again soon. Down around Somerset, Kentucky, or Bowling Green, or Paducah. And then there's John Cornyn, or the other senator from Louisiana who isn't John Kennedy. Or the senator from Georgia who's up, or Precious Lindsey in South Carolina, or whichever one of those, Tom Tillis, I guess, is Tom Tillis up in North Carolina? I mean, the list is endless, and you're going to have to change a lot of hearts, a lot of minds in places where that's hard to do for Democrats because fetuses. Do you realize what a firewall fetuses are against good government? For a fact, they are. Go figure. And I had a note a little bit ago from our buddy Les. It's kind of hard to read because Skype is kind of small print, but in the wake of the news on the shooting in North Carolina, Les says there will be blood. Trump is the direct cause of this, and as Congress gets closer to getting him out of office, his gunned-up Nazi followers will start to coordinate their attacks. There is still a declaration of emergency in force. Thank you for the reminder, Les. Trump is a racist sociopath facing death in prison along with his family the day he steps out of the White House for the last time, if we can get him out in 2020. Remember, the statute of limitations on all these obstruction charges or potential obstruction charges run out in 2022. He will call on his very fine Nazis to create the emergency to fulfill the declaration and seize all power to himself. This is the most straightforward path I see to him becoming a full-on fascist dictator. At this time, gun control only disarms the left, black, brown, gay, the other. The white-wing Nazis and Klan will never give up theirs, assuming they would ever be asked to, and I'm not making that assumption. As a black man in the land where at any minute I could end up on the business end of one of these assholes' ARs, I fully reject disarming and waiting to be killed. God damn it, I sound like one of these NRA scumbags. Good guy with a gun. And I fucking despise them. However, I wonder how many bump stocks have been turned into the government so far. I'm willing to bet the load I'm hauling now that the number is zero. I do not feel okay with what's coming, but I'm trying to prepare myself, my family, friends, and even strangers who also have targets on their backs to tool up for self-defense. I understand the impulse, Les. I understand the impulse. What's that, Mike in Cascadia? Cowbell for Bob, says Mike. Okay. Fetuses are a firewall for good government. Well, I mean, it never occurred to me to think of it that way before, but it's true. You could probably go all over the former Confederacy and maybe even win a few elections if it weren't for the weaponization of little wads of tissue. There's a reason that Julius Geezer did what he did in Green Bay last weekend.
The baby is born, and then they wrap it up beautifully and very carefully, and then the mother and the doctor decide whether to execute it.
That is simply not goddamn... You know. It's not real. It doesn't happen. But it works like some sort of spell out of the Lord of the Rings on people who have next to no civic understanding and no desire to have it. They simply want to be told how evil the other are. Yeah. Okay, let's run over and see who we've got on the stress line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Happy Tuesday to you too, Bob. It's me, Reggie from Decatur, Georgia, yet once again.
What's happening, Reggie?
Summer-like spring day. Well, you brought up the NRA earlier. If you can make all those people who work for and worship them, who get their paychecks from them, you know, blood money, if you could push their faces all the way down knee-deep in blood and make them smell and even lick, taste the blood. And do you think they, and you say, are they happy now? You know, do you think they would change their mind or what? Do you think that would make them actually change their minds, Bob, or what?
When some of the good Germans were marched through the death camps, even then they were unwilling to recognize how evil the actions that had been taken in their name were.
Yeah.
So maybe some, but maybe not enough.
Right, but like I said before, they like having all those firearms on, so they can go in the backyard, you know, in the afternoon, evening, or even at nighttime to play, G.I. Joe, Rambo, RoboCop, and the Terminator on their backyard fences or poles if they have any back there. You know, shooting things off of them. You know what I mean, Bob?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think all these massive shootings have started. This may sound crazy, but I think it started with radical right-wing AM, FM, Republican hate talk radio, conservative hate talk radio.
I don't know that we can say that it started there, but that has certainly fed the impulses. I mean, we know of specific instances. We know of all the nights that Bill O'Reilly hollered Tiller the killer, and once again maybe fetuses, and the next thing you know, somebody goes out and executes Dr. Tiller, assassinates him. The other classic cases. Adkison in East Tennessee, who had a bookshelf full of right-wing hate and left a manifesto stating that they inspired him to go and slaughter people.
Right.
And then there's Glenn Beck and the guy who had to drink his courage before he could go out and attack the Tides Foundation. And it was something we would call a miracle because he got busted for DUI before he could get there and start murdering people, because Glenn Beck had been hammering on the Tides Foundation.
Right. But I wonder, when will it end? When will it finally end? I mean, because words do have...
Maybe that's what we have to come to terms with, Reggie. Maybe it doesn't.
Maybe it doesn't. Well, like you said, words and actions both have consequences, do they not, Bob? I mean, whatever you say over the airwaves, you know how many people listen to talk radio? You know how many psychotic nuts listen to talk radio?
That's probably a majority of the audience.
I mean, I think they're being, I don't know, programmed or brainwashed to do these
things. And the things they can get away with, I've got a great example here. It doesn't have anything to do with the NRA.
Go ahead, Bob. I'm all ears.
Over on the Laura Ingraham show.
Yeah, radio or TV?
TV.
Go ahead, man.
I'm trying to find it. Oh, dang it. Just give me a second.
Right. Okay, Bob.
Hold on.
Don't worry, I'll wait.
Ah, there it is. Yeah.
Oh, I figured you'd
find the lieutenant governor of Texas, right-wing freak by the name of Dan Patrick, who has run all kinds of campaigns against all kinds of marginalized communities.
Right.
He shows up on Laura Ingraham's program and refers to Beto O'Rourke as light in the loafers.
That's a gay reference if I ever heard it.
You're damn right
it is.
Gay
reference.
Yeah, it's an anti-gay slur.
Right. And what did anybody say in return or in response to that?
In fact, he said, he is so light in the loafers, he floats off the ground at times. And
Right. Even
nasty, hateful, vile old Laura Ingraham had to jump in to rehabilitate the witness. She said, you just meant not consequential, correct? You didn't mean any pejorative, right? That's called leading the witness, Reggie.
Yeah.
Oh, no. What I meant is he flaps his arms a lot. People might think something else. I mean, he's a lightweight.
Right.
Light in the loafers. But if Laura Ingraham hadn't jumped in and saved him, everybody still understands it as the anti-gay slur that it is, which is what filthy right-wing rednecks like Dan Patrick do. You know, they use an anti-gay slur whether you're gay or straight, because the worst thing they can imagine is being gay. I mean, it happens on the playground, in middle school, and I'm not going to use the words, but yeah, it happens. And it doesn't matter if somebody's straight or gay. It's just the accusation that conveys the full force and effect of the absolute hate that the speaker has for the person he's used the epithet on. Ah, wait a minute. There's our problem. Hold on. Hold on, Reggie. It's happened again. Daggummit. I hate it when this happens. And... yeah, you got all quiet for a minute there, and that explains why. But
yeah,
you're back.
I can hear you perfectly. Yeah, I'm back.
Yeah.
I can hear you perfectly clear now, Bob. You were saying something about Daniel Patrick.
Yeah, Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, will probably someday be governor of the state of Texas. And, you know, just manifested how much he hates Beto O'Rourke by insinuating that he is gay. You know, because nobody's told Dan Patrick, because he's a good Christian, you know, nobody's told him that there's nothing wrong with being gay.
Right. I guess except in his mind. You know, don't you wish that there was like a movie or something that could turn these people gay just to see how it feels like, what it feels like to be gay or black?
Oh, I think more than a few of them already know.
Yeah. Or turning a man into a woman. Not, you know what I mean. How it feels to be discriminated against.
Yeah.
Or turning a non-Muslim into a Muslim, you know, some magical spell that can
Yeah, Twilight Zone stuff.
But not, yeah, exactly. Not permanently, just temporarily, for like a week.
Oh, just long enough for him to learn.
Right, like a week or 2 weeks, right. And then once they return back to normal, then hopefully they've been changed mentally, physically, and yes, oh yes, spiritually. But like I said, they'll never...
That's a bet I'd never... Reggie, that's a bet I'd never take, that they would change.
Yeah, they never learn, and, you know, leopards and tigers never change their spots or stripes, right?
And neither do skunks.
Yeah, neither do skunks. That's true. That is so very true. But, you know, we got far way too many guns out there, Bob, and how do we get them out of the hands of psychotic people? I mean, but, you know.
Well, now, look, I mean, it's as simple as can be. Rule one is eliminating Republicans from the lever, from having their hands on the levers of power.
Right. We got to kick them out of the Congress.
I don't think we could or should get rid of all guns in this country.
Right.
And I'll be happy to explain. Because there are places where they are useful.
Like
and I've said it before, I'll say it again. There's a big damn difference between needing a firearm out here in rural America and having an arsenal of goddamn weapons in the middle of midtown Manhattan or LA. I mean, I don't know how many varmints people in midtown Manhattan have that are worrying their livestock. But that does happen in rural America.
Right. Well, what about Dallas, Texas, where Dana Lush lives? You know, Dallas, Texas. You know, Texas.
Well, I mean, you might want to have a rifle or a shotgun around in case a rabid animal comes about, because you don't want to get up close and try to capture a rabid anything, whether it's a rabid raccoon or a rabid skunk or a rabid dog.
Right.
You don't want to do that. You want to get them at a distance.
I'm not sure
how many rabid animals there are walking around on Wilshire Boulevard, but I'm guessing there aren't as many as there are in, you know, rural America.
That's true. That's so very true. And we got mental, you know, and these people are mentally ill.
No. Jump back. I don't know that anybody's... I'm not willing to... No, I don't buy on the mentally ill part of it, because it takes an intent to get a weapon, load a weapon, chamber a round, find a target, and murder that target. Those are all stone cold sane actions. If we don't do another thing, Reggie, we've got to get smarter about these assumptions that we make, that just because someone is homicidal means they're nuts. It doesn't. It means they are killer humans.
Right. And, you know, you got the NRA backing them up, and, you know, these killers, and they don't want to do anything about them because they're harping against gun control, because, you know, if gun control was truly reenacted, they're afraid that their, shall we say, freedom protectors, as you refer to them, will be taken the hell away from them. They won't be able to protect their land, you know, property, their home, and their family, and themselves. They won't be able to fetishize with their weapons, with their hardware, their firearms, you know, all that stuff. If gun control was truly enacted, reenacted by the right kinds and types of people, like such as the Democratic, liberal, progressive left. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I do.
The ones who are in power right now, like Nancy Pelosi and the rest of them. And like you said, and I wish the NRA would go out of business, too. How about you, Bob?
I think...
You wish they would go out of business?
You got to destroy the NRA. I make no bones about that. And among other things, if the Attorney General of New York is successful in her investigation, she may be able to deal them a massive blow. And when I say destroy them, I mean take their money away.
Right. Take all their money away, and get rid of all of those who work for them. That means no paychecks for them.
There are so many, Reggie. There are so many intertwined factors. How much money goes into the NRA coffers, for instance, from gun manufacturers? They get a lot more money from the gun industry than they do from wholesome, upstanding, Bible-believing Second Amendment gun owners. You can't go very far on the dues that people pay to be a member of the NRA.
Right. Right.
So, you know, you bust Citizens United, maybe you got a fighting chance then.
Right. But they also intertwine with, what, the military and political complex, right? Or am I wrong on that? As well as the manufacturing
complex? Well, sure, and then like I said, if you were to draw a Venn diagram and one circle says NRA and you draw another circle and it says KKK, there's going to be some overlap.
Right.
There are absolutely members of the NRA who are also in the Klan.
Right.
And then there's another circle that says 3%ers, and they're in the NRA.
Right.
And there's another circle that says Oath Keepers, and they're in the NRA.
Right. Right. And they call us snowflakes. But when somebody mentions gun control, they become the immediate snowflakes. You know what I mean? We're not trying to take all of your weapons away. You know what I'm saying? Not all of them, just some of them, like military-style hardware, which doesn't belong on the city streets.
Or right, but their argument, I'm not setting up a straw man because I've heard the argument made.
Well, you don't have any right to tell me what kind of gun I can own.
All right, well, fuck you, buddy. You don't have any right to tell me that I can't defend my property with landmines and mustard gas.
Right. Or tear gas. Right.
Well, right. Fuck a bunch of tear gas. No. I'm going straight to mustard gas. I don't want anybody getting through my perimeter.
Right. Well, like you said, you better plan a whole. You better have your whole entire property booby trapped. If you want that to happen.
Right. You're not arguing in good faith. Fuck you. You said I can't challenge what guns you can have. Well, you can't challenge me on landmines.
Right. And these are supposed to be Christians?
They're Christians and they're patriotic Americans. Sure.
Yeah, they're patriotic Americans. Tell them to go join the military if they're so damn patriotic, Bob. Put their lives on the line.
A lot of NRA members. I don't know if you did. You see any of the coverage from Taliban Indianapolis?
No, I did not.
There might have been some. There were probably a fair number of veterans in there, but the number of people who were old enough to actually serve, young enough to serve in the armed forces of the United States, was a tiny percentage of those in attendance. Mostly it's old, cranky, hateful white people. That's the NRA.
Right.
And then they keep Coleon Noir on to make them feel better about themselves and think, oh, we're not racist. Look over there. It's Coleon Noir. Noted African American gun owner. Oh, sure.
Right. And why do they keep bringing up their past, you know, during the war, World War I, II, Korea, Vietnam, hell, Iraq, all of that. Why do they keep bringing that up to people who've already heard it or didn't want to, who already heard it one too many times before or didn't want to hear it again, or they're just not interested in their war stories? I know that sounds rude, Bob, but, you know, some people just don't want to hear people's war stories. Do you?
No.
Exactly.
History's one thing, but you know, I don't want to. I certainly didn't want to hear Ollie North's war stories. Hey, Reggie, you have yourself a good evening, my friend. We'll talk soon. All right.
All right, Bob.
All right, you take care now.
Cool up there, Bob.
I'm going to try. You enjoy the arrival spring. It's got a lot more spring-like down there than it is, but I think we're finally going to have some here.
Yeah.
You take care, Reggie.
Yeah, and in 2 months it'll be summertime, so I hope you have all your AC and your fans out before that happens.
Yeah, everything's ready to go, and I'm ready to do some weed eating. I love the smell of two-cycle exhaust in the afternoon. All right, take it easy, Reggie. Later, man.
Yeah, you do too, Bob. All right, bye.
Bye. That's our buddy, Reggie. And over to Scott. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Huckleberry Hound Dog, howdy to you, Bob, and to Chirps there, who I fed. She doesn't remember I just fed her. What the hell is going on, kitty? You're a crazy cat. Oh, and she's learned a new trick. When the weather's nice, I'll open the front window, and she likes to sit up on the windowsill and look out at the world. Well, today it's been overcast and cold and raining, and I have kept the window closed, and she sits in the chair next to the window and meows her little kitty head off until I get up and shuffle on over to the window, which doesn't open easily because this is an old building. My world revolves around this cat. And thank you to Glenn in San Diego for all the nice things he said about Daniel Sheehan's videos on YouTube. I appreciate that. I'm glad to have my perceptions confirmed that he is someone who knows what he's talking about. And for those not familiar, Daniel Sheehan, look up What Mueller Missed on YouTube under his name, and also another one he did right before that on oil barons. And you will get a wealth of information that you maybe didn't have before, as we found out from our friend Len. He must be a neighbor if he's here in San Diego. I don't know.
It's a little tiny village there in Southern California, isn't it?
Have you ever tried to walk it? It's spread out. San Diego County, I think, is the second or third largest county.
Well, it extends from San Francisco to Tierra del Fuego, last I checked.
No. San Diego County goes from the Mexican border on the south to, I forget what that mountain range is, to the east, to the Pacific Ocean, to the west, to the tail end of Camp Pendleton, which is all, you're almost in Orange County, because Camp Pendleton, part of it, I think, is in San Diego County, and part of it is in Orange County. So we're what you call your big-ass county, Bob. But that's not why I called.
No,
geographical,
of course not.
Trip around Southern California. A heads up to Reggie about Republicans learning anything by a life-changing experience, like straight homophobic men being turned gay for a week so they can learn something, or misogynist straight men being turned into a woman for a week so they can learn something. Conservatives are not, their inclination is to resist change or learning. And exhibit A, in my case, Your Honor, is Rush Limbaugh. Now, here you've got a guy who, you've got to think that he was picked on all his life for being a rather rotund fellow with a big mouth, okay, and kind of arrogant. So there's that. He's been married more times than me, and I've been married twice, okay? He's in.
Yeah, I think I think the present Mrs. Limbaugh lives in a pit.
Yes. Lower the lotion down in the basket. He's dealt with two bouts of pretty heavy duty opiate addiction. He's
two?
Lost his
two?
Two, I two or three, isn't it?
I don't know. I only knew about the one where he went out and talked to the horses for 6 weeks.
Well, maybe you know more about it. I don't know. But that didn't change him. He's lost his fucking hearing, which is integral to his line of work, because you got to hear what the audio clips and your callers are saying. And he still won't repent. He's more stubborn than Job in terms of that Old Testament story about curse God and die. And the devil kept throwing stuff at old Job, and old Job says, "I love the Lord," or words to that effect in Hebrew. So, but I didn't call about that either. Ask me, Bob. What the hell did you call
about? But in Limbaugh's case, it's not "I love the Lord." It's that, "My friends, the check cleared again."
Yes, it did. Tracy,
it puts the lotion
on
its skin, or else it gets the golden EIB microphone in a place it doesn't want to think about. My friends.
Ooh. I don't even want to think about it myself. Just hearing about it makes my skin crawl. Tracy is on the right track. She checked in briefly about the NRA. What did she say? Not knowing, or she didn't know that the NRA was cognizant of the trouble that their product or the product that they support causes. and she compared it to the tobacco company, claiming ignorance. Don't get me started on the tobacco companies or industry. And I'm not just speaking as a reformed smoker here, and it's not a perfect comparison, but it's close enough for this conversation. Some years ago, about 8 years ago, I read a big old thick book called Golden Holocaust, which is an exhaustive study of tobacco and tobacco product addiction in the world. And did you know that as early as the 1920s, the tobacco companies knew that nicotine was addictive and that the tars and the nasties
Yeah, because that was kind of a golden age of science. That's about the same time that scientists were finding out that if you breathed coal dust for long enough, you would die.
Exactly. They go into that in the book. So we're talking about the 20s and 30s in this country and in Europe. And as early as the 1950s, Reader's Digest, which at the time was not an obscure monthly magazine, did an article, Does Smoking Cause Cancer? Or a title to that effect. And I don't know what their circulation was back in the 50s, but you couldn't walk into most houses without seeing a little copy of Reader's Digest on the front table or the coffee table. And then, I guess it was the 60s or very early 70s, the tobacco companies got together and formed the Tobacco Institute? An association and lobbying arm, you may as well say, of the tobacco industry to put up literally a smokescreen of denial. Because by the 60s and 70s, in the early 60s, about 64 thereabouts, the Surgeon General insisted that the warning be put on the cigarette packs. And actually, the tobacco companies went for that. They signed on to that, thinking that that might absolve them of some blame, because it would put it in the smoker's court in terms of play. Because the smoker would see the warning on the pack, so they were informed. It was like informed consent, okay? And like I say, the gun industry is not the same, but you've got the manufacturers of guns, you've got the lobbying group on behalf of the guns owners and the gun manufacturers, that would be the NRA, and you've also got, isn't there another branch of the NRA that deals specifically in smoke screens, in this case gun smoke, to further obscure
I'm not sure about that particular part of it, but I'm sure they have a 501c4, which is their political arm.
But
it's kind of like back during what they call the Troubles in Ireland, you had the IRA, which was the shooting and blowing people up arm of the IRA, and then you had their political arm, which was called Sinn Féin.
Sinn Féin, yeah. But so we know from this conversation that as early as the 1920s and 30s, scientists worldwide knew the risks. And at regular intervals, the public was informed of said risks, okay? And the tobacco companies fought back in terms of the Tobacco Institute, their bullshit medical and lobbying organization. And it wasn't until the mid to late 90s that action of a meaningful sort was taken to actually hit them in their wallet. And that was handled by a consortium of attorneys general in I forget how many states, who ended up suing the tobacco companies as a unit, the industry. They sued them as a unit, a bunch of attorneys general, in order to recoup the monies that the states were paying out for the health consequences of their citizens in each of the states. I don't see a matching mechanism in terms of the gun industry. So to answer your original question, what can we do to stop this gun madness? It's going to be a long haul.
Well, it is, and part of that long haul is the fact that some years back, the Congress, both the House and the Senate, decided to confer immunity upon gun manufacturers for what's known as product liability.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. That's a big hindrance.
Product liability is a concept that when you manufacture something and you manufacture it in such a way that you knew or should have known that people were going to be hurt or killed by it, a jury can hold you liable, and they can write, and when they get their little jury form, they can write down the number one and start drawing zeros until their hands get tired.
Yeah, or until the pen runs out of ink.
Right.
And you know why Congress did that?
Because of the monumental power of the NRA. And
yeah, but there's another way of putting it. And you
because the check cleared?
It. Oh, the many of the checks cleared. Campaign funding checks from
right.
the industry to Mitch.
And then
and a whole
well,
a whole
yeah,
bunch
and
of
yeah, a whole bunch of Republicans, but a whole bunch of Democrats too.
Bingo.
This is one of those "for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God" moments. Bernie was one of those.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Oh yeah, he happily signed off on immunity for the gun manufacturers, and the gun manufacturers loved him for it. They loved anybody who would provide them immunity from the ordinary course of legal process in this country.
No, I was thinking the checks from the tobacco industry. I didn't...
Well, those cleared too.
You know, I can't imagine Bernie taking tobacco money. Well, maybe he did.
No, I don't think he did. I'm talking about the immunity from suit for gun manufacturers.
See, this is the trouble. When you're talking about things that smoke, you got guns and you got cigarettes and cigars and pipes and stuff.
And barbecue joints.
And now e-cigarettes, who merely...
No, now, damn it, that's not smoke, that's vapor.
I know. But it's I'm telling you, it's like people have got to be aware of the big money that's involved in the guns and the cigarettes and the tobacco and other special interests. God knows oil. God knows coal. It's when you think of what we're up against in terms of making any meaningful change, I've got to be not so optimistic. Because, yeah, we found with the tobacco industry, change is possible. But 1920s to 30s to 40s to 50s to 60s to 70s to 80s to 90s, that's 80 fucking years of billions of
right.
Billions.
It took from the earliest parts of the 20th century until 1968 to get anything meaningful done with regard to black lung.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, staggering
and
when you think of it.
The science surrounding the dangerousness of fine particulated silica. I mean, there's not even any questions left. Even the coal industry can't fight it, and yet here we are trying to get the people who have this shit dumped on them every day some form of relief through the AIC Act.
And
again, that's 100 years worth of science.
Yeah. Speaking of the AIC Act, I sent you my congresswoman.
Yeah, I saw that.
What did you think of that? Was my take on that correct? A non-denial. Hers was a non-responsive response.
I think you were right. She was basically saying,
I'll keep your thoughts in mind.
Yeah.
If it comes
to a vote. It means that she's not willing to stick her neck out and sign on as a co-sponsor of the bill.
What do you do in a case like that, Bob? Because overall, she's a very good representative, and she helped me personally in my case
And I thank you right back, and you put it like that. You know, you've been a great help to me, and you're getting so many things right. I was deeply disappointed that you did not write back and tell me that you would simply co-sponsor this bill, when in fact you say that you agree with its sponsor in the first place.
Thank you for that. I'll use that exact verbiage.
You know, that's the old, I'm not angry, I'm disappointed.
Okay. Well, I felt rather let down. I anticipated a different response altogether.
Well, I mean, I'm not. Look, you know about Appalachia because, A, you grew up in Virginia, and, B, you participate in this program.
Yeah.
For your congresswoman, Appalachia could be on the far side of the moon. And she doesn't see any nexus, and she doesn't see any political upside for signing on to this legislation, even though members of her own state's caucus have already signed on.
Yeah, I know.
What she doesn't understand is that the Appalachian coal that gets burned in China blows across the Pacific Ocean onto California.
Yeah.
So,
and then there was also verbiage in there about, you know,
jobs,
changing over to some other form of energy is not going to be easy. Well, yeah, we know that, but it doesn't make any less uneasy.
Right, but she tried to assuage your misgivings by saying, you know, here in California, we're not going to burn any more coal.
Yeah,
we're going to be wind and solar and hydro, and we're not going to burn any more coal, and so we're going to be clean and green, and you don't have to worry about those dirty little hillbillies.
And see, the irony is, you know, she comes back for being in this district way out here. She's probably flies over Appalachia or Kentucky or these places where this goes on. But, you know, do you really want to be accused of considering places that are not in California like nothing more than flyover country? They're living, breathing, desperately breathing people. Uncomfortably breathing people that she's flying over. They are Americans. And like you were saying early about the representative that said this office belongs to the people of such and so district. Well, that's true in that regard, but Congress is a unit. It's one half of an entire branch of government. And you've got to have a certain groupthink in terms of your peers surrounding you on both sides of the aisle,
right, houses. And to anybody who would say, well, you know, it's going to be different. I can almost imagine, you know, it's 1850, and a letter being sent home to a constituent that says, well, yes, thank you for your letter in opposition to slavery. I appreciate that. And certainly we've eliminated slavery in our state, Scott. But, you know, it's going to be difficult to transition to a non-slave economy for places like Alabama and Mississippi. But you can rest assured, if this comes up for a vote, I'll keep your thoughts in mind.
I might mention that as an observation when I write back to her.
I wouldn't. That's just going to piss them off.
Well, will it piss them off, or will they maybe get the point?
Well, one, you have to understand, she didn't write that letter. Some little staffer did. And it was and since it was an environmentally based, so-called environmental bill, it was probably handled by her environmental LA, or maybe someone even further down the totem pole. I'm sorry if that's wrong. Someone further down the
food
ladder.
Chain.
The food chain. And so she doesn't even know the letter got sent.
Well, and that raises another question, Bob. See, I'm a pain in the ass to a person in charge.
No, if she shows up in the district, and you show up and say, you know, hey, that was really, I got your response, and that was really disappointing. Then she might go back and look at the little staffer and say, why'd you disappoint Scott? He's an older voter. He's not going to miss a chance to vote.
Yeah, I know. That's another fine point. But it raises this point. You know, Congresswoman, don't you know the content of the material being sent out over your name?
No. Don't do that. Don't do that.
Okay.
No, don't do that.
All right.
You've got a friendly. You're not, You don't start wars with them.
Well, you, you're right. See, I'm glad I asked you before I dashed off this angrygram.
You know, it's dear so and so. Thank you so much for taking the time to respond. I appreciate it. Period. Paragraph. I have to say that as a longtime supporter of someone who has supported you with his votes for a very long time, I found your response to be rather blithe, dismissive, and overall disappointing.
And that won't piss her off.
No, that's just candor.
Well, she doesn't know about the letters that she's sending going out.
No, it's going back to the person who wrote it. It'll find its way back to the person who wrote the letter. And if you make a compelling case, you've heard everything. You know, if we're really going to defeat climate change, we have to be serious about defeating climate change in the cradle of climate change. It is not enough for California to turn bright neon green. We've got to salvage the green that's left in America's temperate rainforest in Appalachia, you know, the forest that reseeded the continent, blah, yada, 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 yeah. Yada. You see what I mean?
When I listen to the replay later, I'll make copious notes and let them guide my response, because you know me, I've got a hair trigger when it comes to, if I feel I've been dissed,
I don't, they don't know you. So you got the polite brush off letter. You know, what she told you is if it comes to the floor and Nancy tells her to vote for it, she will do what Nancy tells her.
See, that bugs the hell out of me. I mean, it really does. I mean, I know how the game is played. I wasn't born last night, you know. But still, on one sense, they talk a tremendously concerned game. But then when it comes right down to the real nitty-gritty, as the song goes, it's like, Mother May I is what it amounts to. You know, and if she were left to her own devices, I would hope that my congressperson would have a little spine and a little independence in this regard.
They got lots and lots, as long as it doesn't mean running afoul of the leadership. That's just how the joint works. The other thing you can
Nancy's not in this district, Bob. She doesn't vote for.
No, but the other thing you can do is you can go on and you can find the Californian, the names of the Californians who signed on, and you can say, look, maybe check in with your colleague Adam Schiff and ask why he in California was an original co-sponsor to this bill. Check in with so-and-so, another one. You know,
that's a good idea.
You know, these are members of our delegation, you know, our California delegation.
Yeah. Yeah,
maybe they can convince you why you need to stand up for people who have no effective voice in government whatsoever.
And you're right, by the way. She's been my representative. I've been here almost 20 years, so I voted for at least eight times, every 2 years for 20 years. That's almost 10 times. It'll be 10 times next time, I guess.
I didn't realize she was of such. Then she ought to have a boatload of seniority.
Well, and see, the other thing is, you know how you turn on the cable news and you see a regular parade of certain representatives and certain senators?
The usual suspects.
Well, no, I wasn't going to put it quite that way. And I'm talking about on both sides of the aisle. But then occasionally, and I forget what the guy's name is that I saw on Meet the Press several months ago, and I don't even remember what state he was from, and I follow government pretty closely and news pretty closely, and Chuck Todd says, you know, now the senator from so-and-so, senator so-and-so. And I'm looking at the guy, and I said,
who the fuck are
how
you?
How come I've never, yes, well, this representative is one who you never see. I don't think I've ever seen her on TV, except maybe locally, once or twice in the almost 20 years I've been out here. And I do watch the local news on television. It's like her head's down, and I'm not even sure what committees she's on. I ought to look that up.
Well, let's do that just for the fun of it, because this is a full-service radio broadcast.
And I didn't mean to go there, but since we were talking about lung problems from preventable causes,
yeah,
and well, since I got that response...
Kind of natural, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of topical. It all ties in together, you know. And you know how we get. I might start calling about recipes, and by the end of the conversation, we're talking about, you know, Doug Clark and the Hot Nuts.
Yeah.
If you remember
I get it.
You know?
Let's see here. What's her name again?
Susan Davis.
Yeah, that's...
And folks, don't get me wrong. She has been a wonderful congressperson in the time that I've lived out here. It's just that I felt...
75 years old, born Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Was she that old? I didn't know.
In office since 2003. Degrees from Cal Berkeley and UNC Chapel Hill. Hey, she co-sponsored the Healthy Families Act and the Scientific Integrity Act.
Oh, well, there's my end.
Committee on Education and the Workforce, Subcommittee on Higher Education and Workforce Development, ranking member. She's a Democrat. This must be old. Okay. Armed Services and House Administration.
Yeah, well, I knew she was on Armed Services because we're a big Navy town, Bob.
Oh, I know. I don't, your voice got really low.
I was making a voice.
Yeah, no, you've gotten very distant. Wow, she's got a really nice looking website, no doubt about it.
Is this better?
No, you've just kind of faded on me. Flag request, passport applications, grants, legislation. Committees and caucuses. There it is.
Okay.
Education and workforce and armed services.
Where do you find this, by the way? That might be a good resource.
Oh, I'm just at her website.
Oh.
SusanDavis.house.gov.
I just use the contact thing. I don't guess that I've ever browsed her the rest of her website.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I'll listen to what you had to say on the replay and make some notes so that when I write back, because I am going to write back, because I was a little miffed. I didn't feel like I got
it. Well, no, I read, and you know, I read it, and I mean, I've kind of gotten used to Congress speak. And that was a polite brush off. Why are you live in San Diego? Why are you worried a bunch of barefoot, ignorant hillbillies?
Yeah. But when she said the thing about, well, you know, the energy jobs in certain parts of the country are of long standing, and the switchover is going to be tough. I said, oh, wait a minute.
No, see, that means she. Scott, that means she doesn't know the first foggy thing about the issue. Because there are less than 4,000 mountaintop removal workers. Okay, there are more. You know, there are more teachers in this state, more nurses. God knows, more. More restaurant servers.
So I was disappointed, and I would like to take this opportunity to follow up and to support you in a fuller understanding of what's at stake.
That's so Californian of you. You have been out there a while.
I know. I don't even have an accent anymore or anything. It's just pathetic. Where are my Birkenstocks?
It will, exactly. Hey, Scott, I'm going to roll out of here. I don't know if anybody else wants to jump in, but I got a couple other topics I want to hit. But
Well, do it. And thank you, Bob, for your kindness. You're a stellar human being.
Yep. And I'll tell that to the boss. Sometimes she needs reminding.
Well, Agnes is going to tell you tomorrow, because I hear she's got a special surprise for you for anniversary.
Ooh-wee!
I don't know what she... Is that her laughing?
No, that was... Wait. I think that is her laughing.
Well, there you go. I've got eagle ears. Okay, Bob.
All right. See you, Scott. Bye now. It's our buddy Scott calling from San Diego. You know, I can't thank you all enough for the activism that you engage in on behalf of the AIC Act. And, you know, Scott's a classic case in don't take no for an answer. You know, you don't write back and call them names or anything. You engage in a dialogue. They wrote back, they said something, well, correspondence. You write back and say something back. And actually it shows a certain amount of commitment to the issue. It means that you're not just a one-off. You didn't just get an email from some big green saying, please write, and so you did, so you're done. It means that you're in it for the long haul. That's how it works. Now, I wanted to get to the one other big story that's been breaking all over the place during the time that the program's been on the air. I was checking to see if there's been anything in the way of an update on the UNC story also before we went off the air for the evening. Suspect in custody. Oh, that's interesting. He's a white male, young, long hair. They've got him with handcuffs behind his back. They're leading him into some sort of a room or a building or something. And he's looking over his shoulder and appears to be laughing. 22-year-old Tristan Terrell, a history major who recently dropped out of UNC Charlotte. Students were giving a presentation in a classroom when he opened fire. Jesus. But no, the other thing that I wanted to mention was this business. I find this hilariously ironic. Robert Mueller is apparently downright pissed. The New York Times publishing a story today. Robert S. Mueller III, the special counsel, wrote a letter in late March to Attorney General William P. Barr, objecting to his early description of the Russia investigation's conclusions that appeared to clear President Trump on possible obstruction of justice. This, according to the Justice Department itself and three people with direct knowledge of the communication. The New York Times opines that this letter adds to the growing evidence of a rift between them and is another sign of the anger among the special counsel's investigators about Mr. Barr's characterizations, which allowed Mr. Trump to wrongly claim he had been vindicated. Sounds to me like Mrs. Barr and Mrs. Mueller may not be going to church together anymore. But the upshot is that Mueller wanted the executive summary released, and no. But what I find particularly interesting is that... And the New York Times writes breathless language like, over the past month, other signs of friction between the Attorney General and the special counsel have emerged over issues like legal theories about constitutional protections afforded to presidents to do their job and how Mr. Mueller's team conducted the investigation. Okay. the timing is still damned interesting. And it's just because of the way I think about things. You know, 2 weeks ago, I was pointing out all the things, as I noted last night, I was pointing out all the things that Mueller didn't do that he could have done. You know, things like rewriting 1,000 years worth of Anglo-American jurisprudence that says ignorance of the law is no excuse. And now it's possible to be too stupid to commit a crime as long as your last name's Trump. And has a junior after it. I don't know if we're going to yet find out that it's also possible to be too pretty to commit a crime, but that would be the Ivanka defense, and it wouldn't surprise me in the least. But I mentioned this stuff a couple of weeks ago. And then, as I pointed out last night, Bill Maher, who has a sizable audience that is watched by apparently a lot of people who matter, flayed the hide off of Robert Mueller for essentially being a coward, being afraid to speak the necessary truth to power that this country badly needs. What was the line? We needed Superman and we got Clark Kent. And talking about his fear to buck precedent. And so, lo and behold, that happened, what, Friday night? And it circulated all over the internet and all over the country. I ran part of the clip last night. And lo and behold, by today's paper, you've got Bob Mueller out there saying, wait, wait, they don't understand. I'm not Clark Kent. And it just so happens there's a letter that was written in late March that, for some reason or another, we didn't hear a goddamn thing about until after Bill Maher took him to task on HBO. Suman with a note says, I'm not sure about the letter, Bob. Sounds like an attempt to make sure he's still portrayed as a rock-ribbed, straight-shooting, all-action, no-talk good guy in the media. Suman says, he could have just done his job. One of the things I found interesting is a little passage down in the New York Times coverage. One-sentence paragraph. A spokesman for the special counsel's office declined to comment. How does the special counsel's office still have a spokesman when there's no more special counsel's office? I mean, there technically is one. Because they're still prosecuting Roger Stone. And the New York Times says, over the past month, other signs of friction between the Attorney General and the special counsel have emerged over issues like legal theories about constitutional protections afforded to presidents to do their job. No, they haven't. No, they have not. That's just a straight-up non-fact. Mueller had the chance to say, but for the guidance, I would have indicted. Or as Bill Maher pointed out, he could have just indicted him. And let the chips fall where they may, and make the goddamn court system do its job. But he didn't do that. Instead, he got all Hamlet-ish and indecisive and, oh, mercy sakes, whatever shall we do? I know, I'll give him a road map. Bullshit. So, at some point in time, the only way this gets cleared up is if Mueller himself testifies before Congress and says what he was thinking, or at least justifies the tepid bathwater of his report. Senior Justice Department officials are said to be frustrated. Out in the rest of the country, we say pissed off. Because Mueller just shut down the investigation, drafted the report, and according to the New York Times, these same senior Justice Department officials and Bill Crooked as a Dog's Hind Leg Barr expressed irritation that Mr. Mueller fell short of his assignment by declining to make a decision about whether Mr. Trump broke the law. That left Mr. Barr to clear Mr. Trump without the special counsel's backing. Well, if he's mad about anything, Barr's mad about the fact that he had to do the dirty work and didn't have somebody to do it for him. And those self-same senior department officials were confused. And they felt like Mueller was being contradictory. And so they had no choice but to find that Mueller's report showed that there was no case against Trump. They had to say that. That Mueller left them no choice. You know, except all the times that he refers, and it's as close as he gets to actually doing his job, all those places where he refers to Donald Trump and Donald Trump's presidency as being corrupt. So, I just think it's interesting. That it, you know, 2 days after he gets the biggest public comeuppance so far, and he gets it done to him by a sharp-tongued, acid-witted comedian on HBO, now, all of a sudden, the feud breaks out into the open. And no. And probably the one that hurt the most was the Mount Rushmore joke. That and the Clark Kent. But I'm sorry, I still come back to my original thesis. Of course it came out this way. Republicans don't run around indicting Republican presidents. They just don't. Because in the end, I-O-K-I-Y-A-R. And finally, we started out the program talking about one of Trump's slipshod legal cases. And we closed the program with news that he's lost again. Not on this one, but on the landmark case emoluments clause suit. U.S. District Judge Emmett G. Sullivan slapped Donald Trump down a rat hole and said that a lawsuit by Democrats in Congress based on the emoluments clause can proceed. Now, the Department of Justice can still appeal, although how it is that the Department of Justice is suddenly personal lawyer to Donald Trump, I'm kind of baffled. But the congressional case brought by about 200 Democrats, the Washington Post reported, extends beyond the hotel and provides a potential new avenue for the president's challengers to gain access to a broader array of Trump's closely held finances. Topping it all off was Judge Emmett G. Sullivan's opinion, in which he said that the noble pleaders representing Trump put forward an argument that he, Judge Sullivan, found to be, and this is a quote, unpersuasive and inconsistent. Just like the pleadings in this latest one we talked about at the top of the program. Drip, drip, remember that from the cleanest hunt. Seems to still come in handy. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Thanks for tuning into the podcast whenever you do so. Thank you to all of you who got us through the month of April. Like I said, we start a brand new month tomorrow. And a reminder, Shirley's Memorial Challenge will be on the table for the first broadcast of May. If you like to participate in challenges and you like to double your money, there will be a $200 challenge on the table. And this is a good time to get in on it. Because you never know when the other ones are going to come up. But this one happens every month. Thanks to all of you who keep the program going. Thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks, Sparky, for popping in the chat room this evening. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, head on .live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 years. 20 years leading the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in the sacrifice zone of Appalachia and West Virginia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.